I must say that perhaps I'm being a bit tough on Ian, because I have discovered that he has a softer side. He is sitting in the London studio right now, knitting some booties for Boris's baby. This is a side of you that is new to me, Ian.
Indeed. Well, it's a side of me that does not exist, because I have to say my concern about Boris Johnson's baby, whether it's his fifth, his sixth or his seventh, he's completely unclear as to what the number actually is pretty minimal, I have to say.
But if he can't count the number of babies, how can he run a complex economy? I mean, indeed, these things are linked.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, he should at least be able to count to 10. Or, you know, you might even raise... It's weird, you know, because when I was a kid, you would sort of have this thing on the liberal left of, we'd always have this thing of saying, look, we should be more like the French. You know, the French don't really care if politicians have affairs and blah, blah, because that's their personal life. It doesn't say anything about their political sort of competence. And, blah. And now I'd say those of us on the liberal left look at the Boris Johnson thing, think, was that true? Because you sort of look at his behaviour towards women, just a complete lack of responsibility, literally unable to say how many children he has from this variety of women, and think, well, there does seem to be something from that lack of responsibility which echoes in the manner in which you conduct government. So perhaps there are some lessons to be taken. I've at least learned that political lesson from this event.
Okay, before we sift through the rubble that is UK politics, do you keep a watchful gaze on US politics?
When I absolutely have to.
You absolutely have to now. How do you think that clown car is going?
Not particularly well. I mean, from my perspective, I don't see any of the Democratic candidates seeming to be particularly inspiring. We're a bit sort of stuck in Britain because Bernie Sanders comes across so much like Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, they really do seem tremendously similar on a policy level, on a presentational level. And we've just obviously been burned very, very hard. Now, it's always dangerous to just sort of try and project from one political culture to another. However, from the British perspective, that does not necessarily seem the right way to go. To put it on the other side, there is at the moment a massive amount of capital on authenticity. Like, that is ultimately the thing which seems to work, whether you're looking at Boris Johnson winning the election, whether you're looking at Donald Trump. If you look in Italy with Salvini doing terribly well when he was in government, over and over again, and even I would say Sinn Féin in the Republic of Ireland, authenticity, a simple message delivered like you really are who you are saying, and not by the kind of rote, controlled managerial manner in which politics was conducted before, does seem to be the way to go. And that does point more towards Bernie Sanders. So it's a bit of a tough call.
We're talking to Ian Dutton. It's been ages. We didn't get to talk about infrastructure, the on-again, off-again, now back-on-again, high-speed rail line to the north. We keep thinking about one of those two, Ian. Boris's big cabinet reshuffle. Coronavirus hadn't really sort of become an issue. Anything else we've missed in our absence?
It's hard to know where to start. I mean, I suppose the main thing that is actually occurring right now in British politics is ultimately about the Home Secretary, Priti Patel. Now, Boris Johnson has already lost his Chancellor in just the opening weeks of his government. It's very unusual for this to happen. He left just before a budget, essentially because Downing Street has decided that it's not content with attacking journalists, it's not content with attacking the judiciary, and it is now, or the civil service, and is now going to extend those attacks to even scrutiny from within government. So it tried to attack the Treasury, where the Chancellor operates, and tried to bring it under Downing Street's control. The Chancellor refused and resigned. Now we find that the Home Secretary, arguably the third most important position in government after the Chancellor and the Prime Minister, also looks like she may be on the verge of resigning as she deals with a scandal over her bullying of staff.
Well, that sounds a bit Donald Trumpian, you know, to lose. He loses everybody, Ian. I mean, to put it in context.
Indeed. So, I mean, Priti Patel is quite a notable figure. I mean, she is, I mean, powerfully imbecilic, even and quite noticeably so, even in this cabinet, which is made up of some of the least competent sort of frontline politicians that we've seen in my lifetime. She was once, I mean, former international development secretary. At that time, she had to resign because she sort of accidentally conducted a shadow foreign policy operation with Israel. She went there on holiday without any authorization from government and just started chatting to people, was foolish enough to allow the Israelis to take her into internationally contested territory, which is something that on principle, the British government would never allow a minister to go into those areas because it does not legally recognise them, and came back seemingly unaware of the severity of the behaviour that she had just conducted and promptly lost her job. Now, the idea that someone would be barred from frontline British politics because of incompetence is now tremendously old-fashioned. And the only real barrier is not believing in Brexit, not showing full loyalty and commitment to Boris Johnson. So she was put back in a senior position at the Home Office, and already it seems to be falling apart. Philip Ruttman, who's the most senior civil servant at the Home Office, he's been there for decades, has now resigned and is taking her to court for bullying. And stories, I mean, that, by the way, is unprecedented for the civil service. The entire culture of the place is about you do things in a hushed up way, you do it quietly behind the scenes, you take care of them that way. He has gone massively public. He's not a particularly nice guy. I mean, he's presided over an absolutely brutal regime against immigrants in this country. So watching their battle for someone like me, it's like Alien versus Predator, you know? I mean, you really don't have any side that you're picking on that fight. But nevertheless, it looks like it could end up toppling her.
I haven't taken a great interest in patent offices since Einstein worked in one, I think, in Berlin. But you're quite sort of het up about a patent issue, which you see as patently absurd to
be guilty of a pun. And I know it does sound tremendously boring, but there was an opportunity. You know, even when Britain left the EU, the Europeans were looking at something called a unified patent system. Now, at the moment, if you want to sort of lodge your intellectual property, you come up with an invention, you have to go to each individual European country and get it in that language. You know, one for Italy, one for Germany, one for France, and on you go. And that's tremendously inefficient. The European system was, well, fine, well, let's just come up with a patent that covers the whole continent. Basically, the way that Europe does everything is going, well, let's just make it one thing, make it very simple. Britain, even when it left the EU, was still planning on being in this. We were going to have one part of the court. Britain is a huge patent sort of system. And what it really offered was an opportunity for two things. Firstly, for Britain to become a global leader in life sciences. It was going to have the life science part of the court. It already has the Wellcome Trust here. It did at that time have the European Medicines Agency. The second thing that it offered was a chance to create a patent infrastructure which could challenge America, and which most analysts thought this can take on America. And this is the kind of thing, I think it's notable for this reason, that when you leave the EU, you're not just damaging the things that already exist. You're damaging the kind of things that your country can do and become a world leader in. Now, it was announced last week. Let me correct myself. It wasn't even announced because the government apparently feels no need to announce these things. It was confirmed from an email to a journalist that they decided to completely pull out of this system. Now, that'll damage Britain. It won't have the chance to be a world leader in intellectual property. It will damage the EU because the system means much, much less without Britain involved. And it just sort of goes to show the way that you're sort of just cutting off your future. Now, within moments of that decision being made, Michael Gove was in the Commons confirming that Britain was going to need tens of thousands of new customs officials. Now, customs officials previously did not need to exist. I mean, we do half of our trade with Europe. All of it flows completely freely, without checks, without taxation. Now we are going backwards in time and creating job opportunities in an area that really are more suited to the interwar years than they are to now.
I understand you're talking about up to 50,000 people.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, you know, huge job opportunities if your industrial strategy is 70 years old and staring back at, you know, even the Victorian sort of period. If you're thinking about where the future is, you would want those jobs to be going in things like intellectual property, which as you look at pharmaceuticals, as you look at the way that sort of the technological developments in the automobile industry move, that is the area where you can succeed as a country. But instead, we seem to be peering in the opposite direction.
Ian Dunt is talking to me whilst you hear the click of needles as he continues to knit booties for Boris's baby. Now, this is going to still the needles. Voting kicked off last week to decide who will become the new leader of the Labour Party. A long process, takes weeks. Tell me what you think about the front runners.
So, I mean, there's only three left at the moment. Coming right in sort of the back in third place is Lisa Nandy, young Wigan MP, very impressive. I mean, you know, has a Leave, a sort of, a bigger part in a Brexit constituency, was quite sort of pro-Brexit, but ultimately very keen on freedom of movement. Quite thoughtful, quite genuine, and has been very honest about the scale of the challenge the party faces with anti-Semitism. In second place, we have Rebecca Long-Bailey, who is the sort of continuity Corbyn candidate. Not an impressive figure, a sort of like a kind of automaton, really. He doesn't really seem to have any independent thought. And in fact, really has been put up there as a sort of human meat puppet, really, by the trade unions and what remains of the Corbyn infrastructure. So, yes, it's hard to find a single independent thought which emerges from her mind. And in front place, we have Keir Starmer. Now, Keir Starmer is quite an interesting figure, very serious, very professional, very competent, not a charisma powerhouse, it has to be said. But it's just about possible that when people have a few years of Boris Johnson trying to manage, you know, the coronavirus and the extraction from Europe, they might actually want someone serious.
Yes, who gets to vote for Labour leader? Is it caucus members only or the party at large?
So it's the party, it's a tremendously convoluted selection structure, which sort of starts off with MPs, then moves to the constituency parties, the local Labour parties and affiliate bodies, then moves to the membership and people who are members of affiliate bodies. So organisations like Labour Against Anti-Semitism and the Fabian Society, Momentum, they will get a vote as well. They don't have to be pure party members. And it's going on over the next 5 weeks. We'll get a result in about four.
And you think Starmer is ahead by a nose or ahead?
No, he's fully ahead now. I mean, most of the polling we've seen, and this polling, internal party polling by YouGov, hasn't ever been wrong in the past, actually. They do a very, very good job with it, and he is absolutely streaks ahead. So at this point, it would be tremendously surprising if it was to change. Look, I mean, I have to say, there are reasons for caution. He is not, like I say, he is not particularly charismatic. What he is incredibly intelligent, very disciplined, and his values are in the right place.
Oh, I think incredible intelligence will work against him. I can't see that being a positive attribute in any democracy that I can think of. With Labour essentially leaderless, Ian, has that given Boris and the Tories entirely free rein?
Yes. I mean, they can do whatever they want. They have this huge majority in Parliament. Basically sort of started to decimate the civil service to try and make it behave and not hold up what they're doing. They're now conducting the beginnings of an attack on the judiciary, on the Supreme Court, talking about pulling Britain out of the European Court of Human Rights. The entire liberal project of a separation of powers, you know, which is about 400 years old, but took on a special shape after the Second World War, is being slowly dismantled. And yet he is profoundly ineffective at it. I mean, Boris Johnson can hardly ever be seen. He seems to think that his job is to stay away from me, media, away from scrutiny, and deliver most of his communication through, surprise, surprise, Facebook, where he does these sort of inane Ask Boris video things where people say, he selects the questions. And so, of course, you know, question one is always, how is it that you make your hair look so wonderful? And question two is always, how can you be such a fun guy, but also such a great leader? And you think, well, my God, you know, you've really just stripped down the concept of scrutiny altogether. And not very effective performance. So, I mean, now you feel a slight moment of danger with the coronavirus scandal because there is a sense that he's not in control. The government itself is dealing with it rather well. But when it comes to a crisis, someone that looks like him, who behaves like him, isn't necessarily the guy you want in charge. And that's something that people are now discovering.
Okay, we've only got 2 minutes left. So a brief riff, if you would, about the Australian-style immigration system that's being advocated, and you don't like it at all.
No, well, I'm rather a fan of freedom of movement on the European model, which gives the individual the freedom to move without the state getting in their way. It's essentially one of the greatest liberal accomplishments, along with international human rights law, of the post-war era. However, Australian points-based system is one of those phrases that has cut through in the immigration debate over here. I think not so much because of the reality of the policy, but because it has a sort of cultural element. What it sort of says to people is, look, you know, the Australians, they're basically just like us, except they live in a terrifying country where everything can kill you. You know, they speak English. So that's the kind of thing that we want over here. In fact, what they've delivered is not an Australian points-based system. Australian points-based system says, if you have the points, you can come over and look for work. What they have actually put forward is you need to have the job offer, and then we will chuck the points on top of it. So even on the basis of the policy, it's incorrect. On the basis of what it would do to Britain culturally and financially, it is absolutely ruinous. But nevertheless, that is the program that the government intends to pursue.
Are you as proud of your passport as you used to be?
No, the Brexiters have made a tremendous amount of noise about the fact that they've managed to change the colour of the passport from red, which it was under the EU, to blue, which apparently it was before we joined the EU. I can't even begin to tell you that the amount of nonsense that is spoken on this. This is considered one of the great achievements, the changing of the colour. What, of course, they do not mention is that the change of the colour comes with a rather terrible caveat, which is that British people have lost the right to live and to work and to fall in love and to start up new lives in 27 other countries, most of which have far better weather than we do. Nevertheless, that caveat is rarely mentioned.
I'm talking to you from a beleaguered national broadcaster, which is constantly under attack from the right, and you, of course, are living in a country where the BBC is about to be sort of imploded by cancelling the licence fee, but we'll have to leave that to our next encounter. Thank you very much, Ian. Ian Dunt, we'll talk again in a fortnight. Ian is editor of politics.co.uk.